Good evening, Oshkosh. My name is Wing Commander Sasha Nash. I have the privilege of being the officer commanding of the Royal Air Force Aerobatic Team, the Red Arrows. And we are absolutely delighted to be here in Oshkosh. This is the culmination of the end of a six-week tour that we've been doing here in the United States as part of the celebrations for the 250th Independence Celebration. And we've had an incredible time, and it's been topped off with our experience here. Oshkosh is a place we have never been to before, either personally or as a team. And my word, it has exceeded every single expectation that we had for it. We really hope that you enjoyed seeing our display, which the display pilots have literally just got out of the jets and come straight here from. And we very much hope that you've got some amazing questions for us, which we are happy to answer. Before we go ahead, though, with that, I'm just going to introduce you to the rest of the team.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Wing Commander John Bond, Red One, the team leader. This is my eighth season on the team, having previously been on the wing for 5 years until 2022. I then came back as the team leader in 2024, and this will be my last season on the team. I previously flew the Typhoon at RAF Coningsby in Lincolnshire.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Flight Attendant Rob Thomas, Red 2, so I sit on the right-hand side of the boss. My nickname is Grob, so you may see that in the papers one day. I'm also a Typhoon pilot, and I've flown Typhoon for 12 years prior to joining the team in 2023, so this is my second year on the team. Thanks.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Flight Lieutenant Andy McEwen, Red 3 this year. This is my second year on the team. Prior to joining, I flew the US Marine Corps AV-8B Harrier. That was an exchange job out here in the States, which I loved to bits. Then I had to go home. I flew the F-35B, and here I am now in a red suit flying the Hawk.
Good evening, everybody. Squadron Leader Chris McCann, I'm Red 4. It's my third year in the team, and this will be my final year on the team.
Evening, everybody. my name's Flight Lieutenant Dusty Wales. I'm Red 5, as you may have guessed by the numbering system. it's my third year on the team. It'll also be my last year on the team. Before I joined the Red Arrows, I too flew the Typhoon at Coningsby.
Evening, everybody. I'm Flight Lieutenant George Hobday. I'm Red 6 in this year's team. The solo lead, or synchro leader as we call it, with Red 7, we do the opposition passes. It's my third year on the team. Luckily, it's my penultimate year. I've got an extra year. There's a fourth year next year. And before this, I came through flying training, so about 12 years of flying training experience, 3 years on the front line flying Eurofighter Typhoon, and then joined the team.
Hello, everybody. My name's Flight Attendant Ollie Suckling. I'm Red 7. Before I joined the team, I flew the Tornado GR4, and I was an instructor on the Hawk T2, which is a newer version of the Hawk. And yeah, this is my fourth year on the team, and I've got another year to go next year as well.
Hi, everybody. I'm going to throw the numbering system out a little bit. I'm Red 10. So we do have 8 and 9. One of them's at home, and the other one is out and about today doing something else. They don't fly in the aerobatic display, but they're vital for supporting our other transit activities, and they'll be joining the team next year. As Red 10, I'm in my first year doing this job, but I previously flew Eurofighter Typhoon, and I spent 3 years flying with the display team. I flew as Red 2, Red 7, and then Red 6. So I was synchro lead when I finished the team. I'm now the commentator and the senior supervisor for the display activity.
So I understand there may be some questions for us.
Absolutely. Question number one is simply, what have you thought of being in Oshkosh so far?
Well, I can probably pass this down the line to a number of people, but for myself, it's been absolutely incredible. We all are massive aviation enthusiasts, and to come here is just been absolutely phenomenal. The scale of how this is conducted and the wonderful people just really shows us that the love for aviation over here is exactly the same as the love for aviation that we have back at home. I'll just see if anyone else wants to add to that. It turns out I said it all. In which case, next question then, please.
The next question is, do any of you fly recreationally on your own time?
We're going to pass it down.
Yes, I do. I am the super aeroplane nerd of the team. I first started flying general aviation stuff when I was 16, 17 years old. Usual stuff, Cessna 150s, PA-28s. I did my tail dragger rating on a Cessna 120, and I own a share in a Chipmunk, which I love very much. I'm also fly classic jets, so Jet Provost, Strike Master, and NAT. So I'll pretty much fly anything that anybody lets me fly. So if anybody's got any nice airplanes and wants to fly, I'm available. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
One question was, have you tried Wisconsin cheese curds yet?
We haven't yet, I don't think. Has anybody tried it?
No.
We've heard a lot about it. It's on the list. We've been working our way through American delicacies while we've been here for last 5 to 6 weeks, but we do actually have to fit into some immersion suits to go home as well. So, yeah, cheese curds, but maybe only in moderation.
How did you know aviation was the thing that you wanted to do?
I think, personally, it's a bug that you get bitten by quite young. I always wanted to be involved in aviation, wasn't quite sure in what capacity. And I think it's one of those visceral moments when you go to an air show when you're young and you kind of feel the roar of the engines in your chest as the engines go and see the beauty that can be generated as well from all of that power kind of military might as well in some capacities. So wasn't sure how I wanted to do it, whether I wanted to go commercial or military, but actually joined the University Air Squadron while I was at university or school, as you guys call it. And that kind of persuaded me to do it. You can only really go military to commercial and not the other way. So, and I don't look back and regret that at all.
Thank you. One question is, what is the process like to make the team?
So to be eligible for the team, we are all, as you noticed from the introductions, we're all from a fast jet background within the Royal Air Force. So you have to have flown a military fast jet for a minimum number of hours. You have to have attained a minimum grading of your ability in the air. And then after that, it's an application process. So every winter, the team will send out an email to everybody who's a fast jet pilot in the Air Force. So we're taking applications. You send in your service record. The team leader will look through all of the service records that come in. He'll sift them together with the team, and they'll create a short list of between 7 and 9 people. Once that's occurred, those 7 or 9 people will go out with us to our winter training exercise. You saw some videos in the clip earlier. and they'll come for a week. They conduct a flying test, a formal interview, some media tests. And really, they spend a week with the team primarily just to integrate with the whole team, whole group, to understand, or for us to understand what type of person they are, and for them to understand what it's like being on the team, full-time. Once that's happened, then we will again rack and stack everybody at the end of that week based on how they did on all of those interviews and flying tests and all of that. And then there's that personal side of it as well, where we work out who performed the best outside of the quantitative data. Once that's happened, then the people at the top get picked. They get a letter, they get a phone call and a letter to say that they're in, and then they convert to the Hawk and they start their journey.
Do any of you come from flying backgrounds, meaning your parents or grandparents were pilots and got you into it?
My grandpa, I think, flew Cessnas like a long time ago. I think he might have taken me for a ride once, but that was when I was very, very young. I think that might be the only one. Your dad was an air trafficker, number 10, so yeah. That's vaguely involved in aviation as well.
My family are actually farmers in the centre of England, so we had nothing to do with flying. However, it was the Red Arrows that inspired me at 11 years old at an air show in Lincolnshire, and watching them pull up in the Diamond 9 into a loop and seeing the sun shine off the back of the jets, that really inspired me at 11. And was from that point I wanted to be a Red Arrow, so the dream's fulfilled.
Ooh. One question was, how did you get your airplanes here? Was there some sort of a ferry flight, or did they have to be shipped?
Very good question. Unfortunately, there was no shipping involved. We had to fly them manually all the way from our base at RAF Waddington in Lincolnshire, right across the east coast of the USA. Took us 3 days. We started off in Waddington. We went up to Stornoway in Scotland. We then went to Keflavik in Iceland. Iceland across to the western coast of Greenland. Greenland to Iqaluit in northern Canada, and then down to Goose Bay, and then on to the eastern seaboard from then on. Took 3 days. Unfortunately, there's no in-flight catering, no autopilot. We are sat there right on the maximum range of the Hawk, which is around 700 miles, and we're there for kind of 2 hours watching the world go by. A real team effort to get us here. The Royal Air Force provided a number of platforms to get here safely. The Envoy, which is our VIP aircraft of the Royal Air Force, a couple of A400, so the big transport planes, and then a P8 search and rescue aircraft. So they all helped us get across the pond, and you'll be seeing probably a couple of them landing on Sunday or the next early next week to then take us back across the pond, exactly the same route. Hopefully we'll be back in the UK by the end of next week.
That's a lot of flying time. What is your dream airplane to fly? If there was one airplane out there that you'd have a chance to fly, is there one that stands out? Anyone?
When I joined the Air Force, I actually wanted to fly the Harrier, but we got rid of ours, I think, in 2010. So I did end up flying my dream airplane. From here, though, what would I like to fly next? Anything with more than one engine, to be honest, because that's all I've flown. And it does get a bit nerve-wracking when you're flying over the polar caps. Yes, and number two here can see all the sharks and the polar bears from 35,000 feet, and he's more than pleased to remind us of that when we are at 35,000 feet.
Someone wanted to know, on the way here, did you all race each other's planes to see whose was fastest?
It's a nice idea. As Bondi, the team leader, has alluded to, we're absolutely on the maximum range of the aeroplane, so unfortunately there's no racing to be had. Those escort aircraft do a great job for us, not only at escorting us across the Atlantic and those polar ice caps, but also at keeping us entertained. So on our sort of quiet frequency, they do occasionally come up with some quiz questions for us to keep us all focused while we're on that long transit across. So it's about 2 hours, give or take, of straight-line flying. So we all appreciate that, I think.
I was just say one thing, that each and every jet has its own characteristic as well. And the way we fly these aircraft, you can really feel how each jet is different. So to answer your question about which jet is the fastest, I'm going to have to say number 7 definitely has the most powerful jet, which is X-ray 177. And unfortunately, I think I have the slowest jet. So I'm going to get fined for that now, for saying that. So. Sorry, next question.
Someone asked, do you have a favorite city that you have visited so far on this tour of the United States?
Oh, I think for me, probably Manhattan. I've been several times before, so I already loved the city before this visit, but there's just so much going on there, so much to do and see. That's definitely a highlight. But also, I've never been to Maine, and I think we can all agree that Maine was really nice. But to be honest, everywhere we've been has been pretty awesome.
We also love the fact that you live on a lake. That's amazing.
Someone wanted to know, what is the toughest maneuver that you do in your performance?
Actually, some of the most difficult things actually are some of the more simple flying. The big wing shapes that we fly in the first half, particularly when you're on the outside of them, are really tricky because it takes an awful lot of trust, an awful lot of teamwork to get it right. As an example, when we're flying the Big 7 roll, I can't actually see the team leader at the start of the maneuver, and as he's calling the maneuver to start, I've got to go with a learned input in order to put the aircraft in the right place at the right time without actually being able to see him. So that takes an awful lot of teamwork, an awful lot of trust and confidence in our wingman and colleagues that they're going to do the right thing as well, otherwise you get quite close quite quickly. And that's why we need around about 4 or 5 months of winter training to get to the point before we can display in front of you. So, yeah, some of the more tricky manoeuvres, the big seven roll and the big wing shapes in the first half. Outside of that, I'm sure Synchro would tell me that getting the pattern to go in the right place during the second half head-to-head passes is some of the more tricky stuff. Do you care to elaborate, six or seven?
Obviously, I'd say that the synchro stuff is the hardest stuff because I have the privilege of being able to do it, so I'm biased. But just to flesh out number four's answer, which is a great answer, we don't fly just by looking at the jet next to us, which is how we would normally operate in formation on the front line or in roles that we've occupied previously. We fly on the boss's voice. So for turns, for example, the boss will only put in his turn input after he said coming left now, for example, and it's on the nut of the now that the boss will start going. For the rest of us, the further out you are, the earlier you have to go. So we're listening right on the outside in that big seven roll, which is nails. It's really, really difficult right on the outside. So poor old Synchro have the toughest job again. We're going almost before the cur, if we can predict when it's coming, the cur of the coming left now. Or and roll, for example, in that specific instance. So the further out you go, the earlier you have to go. And that is something that's unique to the way the Red Arrows fly, because we're all doing it on the boss's cadence and his voice rather than just looking at him, or we should be.
Do you generally fly the same tail number every time?
We try to, yes. So during winter training, a lot of the aeroplanes go off for maintenance, so they're good for the season. So you fly a lot of different aeroplanes. It sort of links into what Grob was saying earlier, that when you fly one aeroplane all the time and you get into another one, these were all hand-built in the south of England in the 1970s, so they are all a little bit different. One of them, literally, it feels like the stick is in a different place because it's so heavy. And the other ones are really light. Some have got more power, some have got less power. So where possible, we try and fly the same aeroplane all the time, mostly just to stop number two squinting about which aeroplane he's flying.
We actually have a question from somebody camping in the North 40. And they wanted to ask, the next time you come, would you consider camping under your airplanes with them?
Yes.
I think that was the whole answer, yeah.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah. You guys didn't hesitate at all. One question was, actually, first off, just let me say there's a lot of comments just saying thank you for making the trip and being here in Oshkosh with us. There's a lot of those. So on behalf of all of us here, thank you. A lot of questions about the weather, and does that ever interfere with the training because of the weather in the UK?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, UK weather, Lincolnshire weather specifically, has some very unfortunate characteristics. Occasionally for us, we get, you know, like a sea fog can roll in and we won't move for ages. And if we get a low pressure system in the wrong place, it can cause us all sorts of problems. That's why we do the training program out in Greece. So, you know, we can work around the weather. We can work around the sort of unpredictabilities of the UK season. And then we go away to Greece to hopefully get a run at some good weather. Unfortunately, it's not just in the training season. We're quite adept at working around weather conditions during the display season as well. So, you know, a UK summer doesn't give you any guarantees of any summer weather.
On average, how many shows do you fly an air show season?
It varies from year to year. Usually it's about the 40 to 50 mark. But clearly for each of those air shows, we've practiced the show in training, the different maneuvers hundreds of times. So the number of shows seems quite small, but the practice that goes into it is quite a lot. And also, it keeps us busy for much of the summer. From May to the middle of October, we're doing shows every single weekend. We get a week off in the middle, and that's it. The rest of the time, we're doing air shows. And we get a couple of days off a week if we're lucky. But mostly, we're just displaying at shows, which is great because it's what we're here to do, to demonstrate our show to all of you.
One of the questions asked was, is this team have the same dynamic as maybe a fighter squadron? Do you guys end up hanging out after and things like that?
Yeah, so ultimately we are all from a similar background. The Royal Air Force is quite small, so most of us already kind of know each other, or at least a couple of us will know the people who first joined the team. I think, yes, we definitely hang out probably a little bit more than normal frontline squadron would. They don't tend to, when you're at home base, obviously everyone will just go home to their families or go and do whatever they want during the week, whereas for us, especially once we're out on the road doing the summer show season, then from about Thursday to up until Sunday night, we're all in the same place together in the same hotel, usually coming out of work quite late. So for the most part, we just go, well, should we all just, someone's booked a table somewhere, we'll all go to dinner together. So we actually spend probably more time with each other than we do with our families in the summer, which I don't think is as comparable to the front line. You probably get, a couple of squadron nights a month or something like that where everybody goes out for a social event. Once we're in the winter training, we probably revert a little bit more to that kind of lifestyle, if nothing else, just to give each other a break from everyone else. But then during the winter, it's much more 9 to 5. We're at home station. We've got all the standard life inputs to contend with. So it's on the road. We're definitely much more tight than a normal squadron would be.
One question was, of all the airplanes you have seen on display here, is there one that stands out that you were really interested in?
Well, they're all very interesting, to be honest. I don't think I've ever seen this many airplanes in one place. And I think the thing I enjoy most is everywhere that we go, every time we go past anything of which most of us don't really know what it is, we'll go, oh, look at that one. That looks quite interesting. And then number 7, we'll be like, ah, well, would you like to know what that is and where it comes from? And, and who built it and what it's used for. So we do have a local aeroplane expert to help us, to help point us out all the individual unique aeroplanes.
I think I have time for one more here. And I think it's been asked several times here, and it is, do you think we will see you guys back in Oshkosh again? And everybody hopes so.
We very much hope so. Yeah, we very much hope so. As we said, we've had an incredible time here, and it's been the absolute perfect way to top off our very successful tour. We're here all weekend, so please do come and watch us display if you're here as well. We also have our PR tent here, so please come down and say hello to all of us, because we'd very much like to meet you all.
Thank you guys so much for being here. We appreciate it. It's truly an honor.
Thank you all very much. Thank you.
Before we start, as we transition, though, we are going to have Lillianne come out and sing our national anthem. So if you can, please rise for Lillianne.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through a perilous fight o'er the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave.
That was wonderful. Every year I always love having her here to sing something. So it's funny because
I think we just find a night that just makes sense to have her sing. I could. I think she needs to start selling. I'm old, so I was about to say she should start selling CDs. So, somebody told me what today. I think if you've been here this week, somebody referred to the 1990s as the late 1900s, and I'm still not okay for them that. So, but tonight we have a really, really wonderful panel to talk about 9/11. We're going to talk about where these folks were. What they went through. Everybody remembers the day, we'll never forget it. And what I'm going to do is go ahead and bring out our panel, and I will lead them in a discussion for a little bit tonight. So thank you guys for joining us. Right now we're going to bring out Michael Fagel from Department of Justice, New York, Matt Nelson, FDNY, Ken Solosky, NYPD, Dave Norman, NYPD, Colonel Mark Tillman, Air Force One pilot on 9/11, General Mark Ramsey, 89th Operations Wing. He oversaw Air Force One and was in D.C. that day. And Jeannie Engel from NASA. So warm round of applause to these guys. While we're going tonight, do not think I'm being rude. We do our Q&A from a phone. And as you guys know, as you've just heard, I'm usually the guy reading the questions. So it's all on my phone, so I'll just kind of go through that when we go to Q&A. We will have a Q&A section, though, so feel free to fire those off. But I just don't want anybody to think I'm just up here sort of like looking at Instagram or something like that. Not what I'm doing. So I'll start off just a little bit about that day and where we were. So for me, for those of you that don't know, I'm a Pittsburgh kid, born and raised. Moved out to Oshkosh, Wisconsin to work here about 13 years ago. Worked on medical helicopters, was an air traffic controller. But before all that, I was working for an airline that doesn't exist anymore now. It's called US Air. And I was working ramp control at Pittsburgh Airport. So for me that morning, I think everybody has that story, right, of where were you that morning. And we're going to go down the line here and we'll talk about that. I was working ramp control, nice sunny morning in Pittsburgh. And we had just pushed our first bank out. You kind of had to time your lunch breaks when the airplanes weren't there. So first bank had gone out, and we were kind of getting ready to take a break. And that is when we first got word that there was a ground stop in Newark, LaGuardia, JFK. And we really kind of couldn't figure that out because it was a really nice sunny day, at least in Pittsburgh. And we figured it was probably the same in New York. So we started to try to figure out what was going on from that point. But some of my friends here on this panel were experiencing things a little bit different. So just volley the question up for you guys. The guys in New York, walk us through your day that morning.
Dave, you mean? Good. All right. Thank you very much for showing up here. It's always a great time to visit you guys, and you always give us an outstanding welcome. But 9/11 for me, personal story, was supposed to be a joyous occasion. I had gotten promoted that day. I got promoted September 9th, I was a lieutenant in Brooklyn, and I was promoted the 9th, effective on the 11th, so my first tour, I showed up as a captain, and instead of going to my normal house in downtown Brooklyn, I was assigned to as a surplus captain in Queens. Found out what happened, just like everybody else, watching the news, and you thought it was an accident, and it was just a tough day, because the guy that had, a friend of mine who had filled my open spot in engine 226, he had just shown up 15 minutes earlier to show up for his tour, and he went out and got killed everybody in the rest of the company except one guy who was driving the rig. I didn't mean to open it the whole show with that, but I hope. But I'm sorry. But Dave? Mm-hmm.
I was assigned to the elite unit in the police department called Emergency Service Unit. Got the call for a plane into the building. I first thought it was a light aircraft of some kind. Only a few months earlier, somebody playing games wrapped himself around on a light aircraft around the Statue of Liberty. So I thought it was something along those lines because it was such a clear day. But we were dispatched right away for a plane into the building. We went, and as soon as we got close enough to see that gaping hole, I knew it was not a light aircraft of any kind. But I didn't really think of terrorism at that moment. And then we got out of our car, grabbed our gear, we grabbed medic bags, we grabbed high-rise rescue equipment, and we were walking as a team in between the two buildings, South Tower and North Tower, 1 and 2 World Trade Center, and that's when the second plane hit the South Tower. And that, when that burst of flame that came through the building, the radiant heat I could feel on our backs. And one of the tires, actually, one of the landing wheels fell maybe 50 feet from us, still spinning and still burning. And then at that point, we decided what should we do, go with our original plan, which was to go into the first World Trade Center where the first building was hit, and set up a medical triage somewhere between the affected floors and the ground floor, so we can try and expedite people out of the building, do, you know, triage and move people on. We stayed with that plan, and we went to the 31st floor of the North Tower and set up a medical triage on that floor. We were working with members of Rescue One, FDNY Rescue One, and we were just basically trying to expedite things and get people out of the building when the South Tower collapsed.
Good evening, folks. My name is Ken Solosky. I'm from the New York City Police Department Aviation Unit. On that day, I was the chief pilot there. I was working. I was not flying at the time. The report came in. I know this sounds crazy, but not unusual in New York City. We get crazy reports all the time. So we launched our standard package, which is a Bell 412 ASC rescue helicopter, which consists of two pilots, a crew chief, and two scuba divers. A Bell Jet Ranger at the time, which consisted of two pilots. Immediately upon liftoff, we're about 10 to 12 miles southeast of the World Trade Center. The crews reported immediately they saw the smoke. So we knew there was an incident. We certainly didn't know the impact. Our initial response was command and control, airborne intelligence for the ground units, and the possibility to see if we could rescue people off the roof. So the units responded. While the 412 is doing its orbits, the second jet came from the south, United 175, almost hit the 412. They had to take some evasive maneuvers, and they too watched that aircraft go right into the South Tower of the World Trade Center, at which time we knew America was under attack.
Now, shifting gears just a little bit, Mark, you want to walk us through where you were when this happened? Oh, hi, we have two Marks, yeah. Mark Tillman.
Hi, I'm Colonel Mark Tillman. I was President Bush's pilot. Education visit to the state of Florida. We left on September 10th, transitioned to Sarasota, Florida. So when all this was occurring, I was sitting on the aircraft waiting for President Bush to leave the elementary school. Saw on the news, basically, and then with command and control, the first and second towers get hit. From that point forward, it was more a continuity of government plan to make sure that the top three, the president, vice president, speaker of the house, were all being taken care of. My job was the president. From that point forward, we countered a lot of threats, but in the end, the folks in New York were doing all the amazing work. Multiple times we went back to New York, thanking all the people and the firefighters, the first responders, et cetera, for the amazing things that they did.
Mark Ramsey, you were in Washington, D.C., correct?
So I was the other Mark Colonel that day. So I had the home guard in Washington, D.C. So Mark Tillman, who I've known since 1989, we were actually hired at Andrews at the same time and flew together. He flew Gulfstreams and I flew DC-9s. And my first encounter with what happened today, it sounds like everybody kind of, the North Tower got hit. I didn't know it. I was actually out driving an inspection team around the base. My secretary called me on what we euphemistically call the brick. It's a giant secure walkie-talkie. And she just said, you need to come back to the office. And I said, I have an inspection team. She said, get rid of them. So I did, went back to the office and watched the South Tower got hit. And I think it was about the same time Mark was getting President Bush in the air out of Florida. As Mark said, the big role we had was continuity of operations, continuity of government. So one of my, can't compete with America. One of my three squadrons was a helicopter squadron, first helicopter squadron. So the Air Force helicopter squadron that I had, along with a Marine helicopter squadron and an Army unit at Fort Belvoir, began moving leadership out of Washington, D.C. I think there's some digital pictures running around. You'll see some of the blue helicopters that we had. They were moving people away from the Pentagon and other sites in D.C. that you can imagine. And we were also not knowing after the Pentagon got hit how bad that was and how many casualties we had. We were expecting, like New York City, we were expecting tens of thousands initially. We were thinking 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000, depending. We were moving medical supplies down. And then one of the helicopters, you'll see, I think, a picture of a, we're right in the middle of all this, and one of our helicopters has to make an emergency landing at Roosevelt Island in the Potomac River in Washington because they hit a giant bird that took out the pilot's windshield. So if you can't make it more exciting than just have a giant bird strike. So anyway, that was the beginning of that day for me.
And Michael, Fagel, where were you? You want to talk to us a little bit your morning?
My morning, I was in the office. My name is Mike Fagel. I was in the office in Chicago suburb Aurora, working on emergency planning. My pager went off. We had pagers back then.
There's that bird strike.
And I was assigned by the Department of Justice to make my way to New York City to join an incident management team. And I went there. I met Chief Charlie Blaich from FDNY, and I was his shadow for 3 months. And we did everything under the sun. You know how a job description says other duties as assigned? That was us, other duties as assigned. And, I became a safety guy. A lot of safety officers were killed in the event, and we were trying to make make things as safe as we could. In my notebooks I've got here, I've got some of our safety plans of what we try to do and draw up immediately, but it was very difficult to keep people in our safety gear. You can see any picture you want. Respirators were hanging on their necks, no hard hats. We didn't want anybody else to get hurt, and that really was our mission.
And something that I never thought of, and I'm sure some folks are asking, like, why do we have, you know, someone representing NASA? And it was actually in a casual conversation that Jeannie were having one day that she told me several stories, and all of which I never thought of, but there is a NASA component to it. And Jeannie, first off, do you want to just tell us a little bit about that morning and where you were?
So I was the chief information officer at Johnson Space Center, but that morning I was dropping my daughter Katie off in front of elementary school and carpool line. As if you have kids, you know how thrilling that is. So I'm waiting in line to pull up to drop her off. I think she was in kindergarten or maybe first grade. And I got a call from my IT security manager who worked for me, and he goes, "Have you seen the news?" And I said, "No, Frank, what's up?" And he said, "You know, plane hit a tower in New York." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "I think I need to call Mission Control and talk to the mission folks and see what they've got going on, and maybe I'll call headquarters and some other people in the intelligence community." I said, "That's fine." And so I said, "I'll be in 15 minutes. So I dropped her off and went into work, and from that moment on, we were just trying to figure out how extensive this attack was going to be at that point, and was it going to go into the cyber world or not. So that's how my day started that day.
Again, never thought of that. There were cyber concerns, correct?
Yeah. And fortunately, you know, Mission Control, our mission systems are completely air-gapped, separate from the rest of the center, but we were still concerned about the center being compromised. Because, you know, you have 10,000 people on site and thousands of contractors outside the gate. So we have interconnections around the world with our partners, our contractors. So we were very concerned at that point, even if we were pretty confident that the crew on board ISS was okay, we were still concerned about what was going to happen on the ground with the rest of the infrastructure and the agency, because if one center was under attack, it could have been a domino effect across all of them.
So you have this, all of these daunting tasks ahead of you, and everywhere you're at, and it is going to be far outside of the normal. So let's go first to some of the guys in New York. What happens next? How does everybody spring into action, and where do you go?
For me, at least, it was just overwhelming. You know, I didn't get in there till later in the day, actually after the towers had come down, and it was obviously like a war zone. I've never been to a war zone, but it was like, how are we ever gonna come back from this? It was just overwhelming. You know, guys, you thought you're gonna do a rescue and recovery operation, but it was more just recovering. At that point, like you said, we thought we would have a lot more casualties, and we hardly came upon anybody. And after digging for a couple of months, it was at least coming up with something for the people to give them closure, whoever lost somebody, a loved one. So, it got a little depressing for a while, and there's actually one story that they had, the cadaver dogs weren't finding anybody, and the dogs were going into depression. So they would have people actually act like victims and lay in the rubble so the dogs would get happy, finding somebody, and they'd reward them. But it was just a tough go.
So communications, as always, was very difficult. So the playbook went out the window. We just kind of were on our own. We expected mass casualties. Sadly, it was either you lived or you died. It certainly were minor injuries, but not to the extent we thought. So for those first few hours, until we established contact with the U.S. military, we had no idea what was going on. As I mentioned, foreign fighters attacking the United States. Was it a foreign nation? We did not know. Air traffic control was confused. Some of the towers, they evacuated, or they asked to be evacuated. Some of the controllers heroically stayed behind. They would help us. And then we finally, at about 9:30 that day, we established contact with the U.S. military. Fighters came from Otis Air National Guard Base in Massachusetts and Atlantic City, New Jersey. So when they got on scene, they took over the CAP, the Combat Air Patrol. So we knew we were safe in that regard, but we still had a whole bunch of work ahead of us.
Well, immediately, right after the collapse, the first thing we had to do is regroup because, you know, two buildings just came down, 220 stories worth of buildings just came down around us. My team was actually caught in what they call a lean-to collapse, where we survived because the debris deflected off of one of the other buildings. And then we had to find each other and put our team back together, find out who was alive, who was killed or missing, and then form teams again and go back in to try and do rescue. It was an all-night affair, obviously. The next morning when the sun came up, I could see a little bit more of what the reality of it was, and the dynamics of that changed. And then you really have to coordinate with every other agency and try and have some sort of security perimeter around the building, around the site, because you know we don't know what's coming in, like you said, you mentioned, who's coming in, whether we're going to have another attack. And you know, we were very, very vulnerable at that moment in time, the city of New York. So it took a while for us to get our act together.
From a moving the president standpoint, were the two marks working together? Rick, were you talking at all that day, or totally separate?
No, it was totally separate. The movement of the president was always its own separate entity. Support from Mark and the others were always there for us. But you know, on that day, the continuity of government slowly went out the window because. Yeah, I jokingly say that all my orders should have a big asterisk on the top that says, "Is your president from the state of Texas? If so, jump to the bottom," because he's not going to go hide and hunker down. And that's exactly what happened. President Bush made the decision he's going to go back to Washington, D.C. So when he was coming to the jet, we knew we were supposed to get back to Washington as quick as possible. The challenge was, at that point, as you mentioned, the FAA was advising there were 9 to 10 other aircraft. Transponders were off, and the pilots not talking to the controllers, which many of you are pilots, you know that happens day to day routinely. That's why you got two transponders, and some of the pilots aren't talking. But that was occurring. So before we took off, we got the recap from the FAA that three aircraft known at that point, two met their targets in New York City. The third was just west of Washington, D.C., American Flight 77, was coming inbound. And as the president's coming to us, United Flight 93 had gone out to the west, and we were getting information on that. So was fully aware of what needed to be accomplished and to move them as quick as possible. But no sooner is the president's coming at us, the FAA advises, Air Force One, you have an airliner with transponder off, not talking to anybody, 130 miles to the northeast of you in Sarasota, we assume you were the target. So at that point, we started making plans to move. And from then on, it was, it's the fog of war happening. No sooner try to take off, Secret Service lets me know there's a man at the end of the runway with a long gun. So I need to turn around on a tight taxiway and take off over the top of him. The guy at the end of the runway was a man who had brought his kids to the airport to film, but he took what appeared to be one of those old VHF cameras out of a gun case. Wrong day to be filming out of a gun case, obviously. But from that point forward, we started getting more and more information about what was happening in New York. Then communications failed for us. And it was just basically coming up with plans to not only protect the president, but keep him in communications, et cetera. So that was our challenge for the day. And Mark had his challenges back at Andrews Air Force Base. So that for me, that was trying to get information to bring the president back to Andrews.
Just to add to what Mark said, we, for the pilots out there, this was the first and only time in history I'm aware of that the FAA, and I understand it was the FAA ops director's first day on the job as a promotion. Wow. You. Where Skatana, how many people in the audience know what Skatana is? Okay, the Skatana means the government takes control of the airspace and all civilian aircraft have to land immediately. And that was done, that was declared about 9:45 in the morning, which made Mark's job easier, I think, as the day went along, because as airplanes landed, that threat from the, you know, the FAA was pointing out went away. We had, as I recall, we had two overseas missions supposed to come back that day with VIPs on them, U.S. government officials. We just left them in place and said, we've got to sort out what's going back at home. And it was all about the continuity of government mission. And then after, I would say, the dust settled around 12:30 in the afternoon, as I recall, when all the planes were declared down, and a lot of them landed, a lot of trans-Pacific and Atlantic aircraft landed in Canada, like 30,000 passengers. I then got a call from the White House going, what do we do with the two prime ministers in town? And I went, you tell me and we'll both know. So we had, they couldn't go home because they were flying on their national airlines. And as you know, we didn't fly commercial air for, I think, at least 3 days. And the National Airport had their own procedures. So that, as the day went along, the challenges shifted depending on this, you know, the situation as we knew it. And certainly the Pentagon being hit about by American 77, that really, that was the dynamic we dealt with in Washington, D.C., which frankly, as it turns out, was a microcosm of what New York City was going through. Thank God the Pentagon was hit in a quadrant of the five sides that had just been renovated and wasn't open completely, so meaning there weren't 5,000 people working in it, there were like 200, and it was the Army section, and the exterior of that part of the building had been reinforced, so the plane penetrated a lot less than it would have if it hit one of the other four sides. So that really helped with the reduction in loss of life, which was under, I think we had under 200 killed at the Pentagon out of the almost 3,000 that died that day.
Switching gears a little bit, you know, Jeannie, we had one American in space, mm-hmm. The only American who didn't experience this catastrophe on Earth.
Yep.
How was that communicated to him?
Well, NASA has a letter that he wrote from space. He started it the day of, he couldn't finish it, and he finished it the next day. But in talking, he said the day started off kind of boring. They were, each of the crew members, there were three crew members, this was Expedition 3, and they had reached the space station and took command on August 12, 2001. So they had been up there about a month. And so Frank Culbertson, naval graduate, 1971, he was the commander, and he had two Russian flight engineers. And that day they were just doing their checkups with the flight surgeon independently, and Frank's discussion with the flight surgeon, he said, you know, we're not having a really good day down here. And he explained what happened. Turns out that American pilot Flight 77 had been a classmate of Frank's at the Naval Academy. And he talks about that in this letter. And if you want to read more about that day, it's on the NASA.gov website. If you don't mind, I'd like to read just some words he put that I think, and I'm going to read them because I don't want to misquote him. And so forgive me for reading, my memory's not as it was. This is what he wrote that I thought was very profound even after 25 years. He said, it's horrible to see smoke pouring from wounds in your own country from such a fantastic vantage point. the dichotomy of being on a spacecraft dedicated to improving life on the Earth and watching life being destroyed by such willful, terrible acts is jolting to the psyche, no matter who you are. Wow. Yeah, I thought that was a very profound way of talking about what he saw and how he could not be on Earth to be a part of helping in any part, because he didn't come back till December 15th. So he could not be a part of any of the recovery or help anybody at all during that time. So, and there's a picture he took. Is it up?
Yep.
Frank took this picture. There's smoke pouring out of Lower Manhattan as they went over New York City. And as the only American, he just has a very unique perspective, a way of talking about how it impacted him.
For the guys in New York, you've got to go to work. You've got to actually try to climb out of this. Can you explain to me, and I know some of you have different experiences, you mentioned a war zone. What was it? What was it like down there at Ground Zero?
Like what Dave said, when the sun came up the next day, you got a broader picture of what you were doing. When I didn't even realize the scope of it. As soon as I got down there, they put us right to work in a small area. You grab a team, and you basically work until you're exhausted or your radio ran out. And they rotated you and, you know, gave you relief. But it was, I can't even think of the words. It's just overwhelming, you know.
Dave, do you want to tell us a little bit about your story of the day and what you experienced?
Well, I think the next day, when trying to put teams together and trying to search, I had a lot of hope the first morning, because there was so many. I was on the south side of the property, kind of the buildings, and I saw a lot of giant openings. I could access rooms, and I thought we're going to start finding people, because we did spend all night that night rescuing two Port Authority police officers that were trapped in the rubble, and we got them out. Almost first light, I guess, the next day. So I had a lot of hope, and then they moved me, my team, to another side, and I just saw the devastation. I mean, there's tons and tons of steel. We couldn't do any of it. All of the tools we had in our toolbox and the rescue business kind of thing, all lightweight. You know, exothermic torches that are like, you know, 36 inches by 3/8 of an inch. They had steel workers come in with 12 foot, inch and a quarter exothermic torches. The tonnage of steel was just incredible. You just couldn't move it, you know. We had dogs going in to search cavities and things, and it just, as time went on, it just became very narrow and depressing.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, too, we're basically going back to basics. We're using bucket brigades, using Home Depot buckets to fill gravel and take it out. And they said, until you get the grapplers in there and start moving things around, nothing was really moving. And they also had to get all the perimeter cleared up with all the vehicles that were crushed or on fire, so nothing could, only big equipment couldn't really get in.
Michael, do you want to talk a little bit about your time going down to New York?
So I arrived in New York City 3 days later, and I was assigned to Battalion 15. Chief Charlie Blage was in the ICP, Incident Command Post, at Duane Street. And our job was to find body bags, flags, cutting torches, bolt cutters. I used to be in safety in my other life, and Charlie knew that I was a safety guy. He said, we need to write a safety plan for the entire site, which was a pretty untenable task. But every day our teams prepared safety briefings that we went to each command post and delivered those briefings about temperature, how many crew, what were the hazards we saw, what we're going to be doing on a daily basis. And we prepared what we called incident action plans, or IAPs, that became what we talked about the entire day. We wrote them the night before with data that we developed by being on the ground. And every single hour was different. There were no 2 days alike. I was assigned to Pier 92. We had a command post meeting at 6 o'clock at night, and I was working as the fire department safety liaison officer, and fire chief at the time was Frank Brothers, and I had an OSHA person here, EPA person here, arguing with each other about safety, parts per million, citations. Fire chief wanted none of that. He said, I don't want to hear about citations, anything like that. He couldn't get a straight answer. What equipment do we need to keep these people in? So he asked me to take these two individuals outside and not let them back in during this meeting. So there were some hard feelings, and I interpreted some of the rules and regulations for the chief and for the team. There were over 80 agencies at the Pier 92 meeting. Everybody's adding to it, taking away. Then we had a 6 o'clock meeting every morning, just preparing data and intel so we knew what was actually happening. Once we hit the print button on our reports, it was out of date. So no matter what we did, it disintegrated quickly. So we had to really act fairly by the seat of our pants and do anything we could.
And Ken, I don't want to miss the day of the attack. A lot of the, if I understood it right, a lot of the footage we saw was from you up there that day. Isn't that right?
Yes, it was. The pilots who went up at the time took video and photos. They were classified for about 10 years. They were declassified about 15 years ago. Matter of fact, tomorrow I'm doing a presentation here as well. I have a lot of those photos in there. Particularly difficult for them. We also recognized pretty quickly, we had about 60 officers assigned to our unit. By about 2 o'clock, we realized we had called all 60 of them into work. And we realized this was going to be an operation that was going to last for days, weeks, if not months. So we had to dismiss half the unit at about 2 o'clock. And police officers, firefighters, we all share the same DNA. We're action oriented, we want to help, we want to get things done. And sending away 30 talented people was extraordinarily difficult for them. They wanted to help. But we needed them to come back later in the evening to split the unit to be able to work 24/7. However, the help we were offered was extraordinary. And I'm just going to give one example, and I could give you 100. The chief pilot for LAPD called me up. He said, how many people do you need? How many helicopters do you need? I'll launch them today, and they'll fly cross country, and they'll be with you guys in a day or two. And I had help offered from the military, units down south, up in Canada, willing to send pilots, mechanics, aircraft, anything we needed, I had at my fingertips. We had an aircraft, one of the 412s was AOG. It needed a part from Bell in Texas. As you remember, the airliners were grounded for several days. We had no way of getting it to us. We reached out to the United States Air Force. That part was flown to Kennedy Airport in an F-15 or 16, I forget. I remember it was on the deck in about 3 or 4 hours, we had the part. I mean, that was the level of cooperation we had. The units, the police agencies that right next to us, Nassau County, Suffolk County to our east, New York State Police, New Jersey State Police, all responded, willing to do anything they could to help us. Safety was always a top of mind. They said, you know, if we want to split crews, we'll put another qualified pilot with one of our pilots so we could force multiplier while maintaining safety. So it was a difficult task. Those first 48 hours, we kind of had a standalone plan. We were not getting direction because communication was essentially severed from our upper command. So we were kind of just going on our own. We had a terrific commanding officer at the time. He ran a terrific plan, and it was just we realized it was going to be more of a recovery of more support. As we mentioned, there were few casualties that we found people alive.
Question: shifting gears slightly for Jeannie, taking, you know, you were the one who had to pull the switch basically to take some of that communication from NASA offline. Was that a hard decision for you to make? I almost think of like in the movie Apollo 13, we have to close a fuel cell. There's no going back. Was it something like that? Was that a pretty big decision?
It was, because we had a firewall around the center, and we, as you heard, everything was chaotic. We could not get any information. It was just a lot of guessing, a lot of maybes or what ifs, is standby. And so I talked to my IT security manager and his deputy, and I said, let's just pull the switch on the firewall. Just leave it so that we can still communicate within the center, but nobody from the outside can come in. And it was a little bit of a discussion, and then I made the decision, and I went up to the center director's office and had a talk with him, and he said, sounds good to me, keep me informed, and that was what we did. As we got better information over time, as the intelligence sharing got a little bit better in the IT security community, we slowly but surely opened things back up. But it never went back as fully open as it started with. And eventually over, I would say 4 to 5 days, we were back to where we had communications with all the other centers, our partners and our contractors. But yes, it was, there was a lot of, you can't do that. We have to communicate, and at that point I'm like, let's just shut the gates for just a little bit and find out what's going on. And so that was the decision I made.
While the communications were sort of refined, did you feel like a change in the tone or the feel? Could you feel that at all in the center, that they were on like maybe a heightened state of things?
I really wasn't focused on that, to be honest with you. We were really sort of in our own little world, trying to figure out, by calling and talking to as many organizations and people as we could, to get as much information as we could. I know that it wasn't a popular decision, because a lot of our engineers needed access to other centers for other things. But again, it wasn't a long-term thing. It was for a few days and limited capacity. And I thought the potential risk outweighed the need to maybe open up communications wide again. I think we were the only center that went that far. But once I laid out the logic behind it, center management supported me, and that's the direction we took.
You know, one question I've probably never asked Mark Tillman is, what does your next few days look like after you get back to D.C.?
So on September 11th, we brought the president back, and he addressed the American public that evening. 3 days later, we brought him up to Ground Zero. I overflew Ground Zero at 1,000 feet, and I'll never forget to this day, still remember all the first responders looking up, many of them saluting as the plane came over, banked to the right so the president could look out the window and see it. Then we landed McGuire Air Force Base. President helicopter the Wall Street landing zone. And from that point forward, we spent the next, multiple years going back and forth to New York. The president told all of us on the crew of Air Force One that anything we can do for New York, make it happen, whether it's tours, whether, it's visiting New York. And that's what we did. We went to a lot of the fire departments. We went to, the Port Authority, NYPD, gave tours. They reciprocated with us and brought us in town and took care of us, and it was incredible what we could see. Just everything that was occurring in New York, everybody came together. Everybody was there, and they were, I went to a unnamed fire department, I can't remember what it is, but the spouses were there waiting for us to give us a tour and introduced us to the hats on the posts or on the pegs and the coats and that stuff, because all of their spouses had passed away. And the other officers and enlisted we had, we just couldn't stop crying. And from that point forward, we did everything we could, as well as President Bush, to support New York. And we were there many, many a time. But that was kind of what our life became at that point. And all of us were excited to do it.
And General Mark Ramsey, what was the mood like in D.C. at this point?
I mean, it was September 11th was just a day of shock, I think is the best way to put it, at least in the world that I was dealing with. I think Americans really began to awake after President Bush gave his speech that night. And the next day when we woke up, it was gloomy and glum, but you kind of got the sense that everybody was picking themselves up and I hate to say this, but brushing the dust off and looking at the aftermath of the day before, because it was pretty apparent by the time President Bush spoke, whatever was being committed against the United States was over, at least temporarily. We didn't think there was going to be any more takeover of commercial airplanes hitting buildings. we didn't, that phase was over. So, and fortunately the weather stayed good that week. It was just, it was chaotic. It was sobering. I went around to, as I mentioned earlier, I had four squadrons. Three had aircraft, one of those was a helicopter. One was the squadron that supported the airfield itself, air traffic control. Well, the FAA ran the tower, but we supported it electronically. And I just went around and everybody looked at me and they all had the same question with tears streaming down their cheeks. Is, what do we do now, boss? And I just said, well, we pick ourselves up and we do what the nation needs us to do, whatever that is. And like Mark with the president, we had a lot of trips with the rest of the leadership. I now live in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. That's the closest airport to where Flight 93 crashed. And remember, there are three crash sites, obviously the horrific problem or the horrific crash in New York City, but the Pentagon has a memorial and Flight 93 has a memorial. I don't know how many trips we made to Johnstown over the next couple of years. The president went up there several times. And I'll never forget the first time I went to that memorial. It was a chain link fence, and the only thing hanging on it were the uniforms of the firefighters in Stoystown who were doused with the jet fuel from the United flight that crashed up there. So, you know, it was a sobering week, to say the least.
You know, one of the things I wanted to ask is, probably more for the New York guys, was how many consecutive days were you there? Were you down at Ground Zero?
Consecutive days? That whole night, the first time, even if you were getting off in the morning, I don't think I went home for about 4 days, almost 48 hours at the site. You're taking, you know, some cat naps here and there until you can, but then you're totally exhausted. And probably about day two, they got their act together. We had a rotation, ABCD chart, where you would work one day at Ground Zero, one day in the firehouse, one day at Ground Zero, and one day off. But whatever firehouses or pretty much the whole job decided no one's going home. But basically sometimes you had to go home. And that was on a Tuesday, and the first funerals we had, there were three on that Saturday. And I knew all three guys, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna make all three, because that's what we do in the police department and fire department. You don't miss a funeral. It's like, I made the first one, got to the second one, there's no way, this is not business as usual. You know, we're in uncharted waters here. So for me, I stayed in that rotation system for about 3 months, and then they were asking, you know, who wants to stay, who wants to go back full time to the firehouse, and I think at that point I was done. I had it, and I opted not to go down anymore to work the recovery effort, and then they had teams that were dedicated now at the third month just working down there.
Months later, order you to take your vacation, because nobody wanted to stop working, you know. And when I went home, my wife was pregnant with my son. So, you know, that's emotional, you know. So it was a long time, you know, we were dealing with things.
In the aviation unit, Chris, we split two 12-hour tours. Everyone worked consecutively, probably for 3 months. I was blessed. On October 3rd of that year, my wife gave birth to our first son. And as Dave just mentioned, emotions, you know, September 11th, and then October 3rd of that year, I welcomed my first son to the world, and the New York City Police Department was kind enough to recognize it, and they were kind enough to give me time off to enjoy that event, and I'm forever grateful for things like that.
Michael, how about yourself? How long were you working straight down there?
We worked 10s and 12s and 16s. No time off. We went from command post to the field to meeting after meeting, trying to get things organized. I remember one day, September 26th, where we're writing a set of general orders when rescue was going to change to recovery. When was that switch going to be thrown, and who made that decision? Because when you change a mission from rescue to recovery, the FEMA teams pull back and things get a little different when you're making those moves. And I can tell you, we all had tears streaming down our faces as we were talking, writing, and understanding that from this point forward, we were going to be changing things tremendously. And nobody wanted to make that decision, but we all did.
I've got notes tucked away in my briefcase to share eventually, but I want to read something from some of the notes we put together. We said to every member, your health and safety is the highest priority. And we try to keep people in personal protective equipment, the right respirators, the right gear. We made sure that each sector had a safety officer. They didn't want to do that. Everyone wanted to work, dig, bucket brigade. And when we try to talk to people saying, you need to worry about these things, I submit to you, it's very difficult to negotiate with a firefighter with an axe in their hand when they've just lost their colleagues. And we tried. This book is full of some notes. One of our meetings, I started writing on the wall, site safety plan, personal protective equipment, falling debris, slips, trips, and falls, airborne contaminants, collapse, biohazard, stress. One thing we never talked about was mental stress, mental health. In the last 10 years, 20 years, I've been on a mental health team for PTSD, helping people, and every one of us in this room has had an event that was very stressful. Everybody on the panel have had events that are very stressful. But the stigma of asking for help, mental help, scares people out of their minds. And we were talking about that 25 years ago. And we had tents around the site. There were first aid tents. There's another tent with a counselor, with counselors in them. NYPD had PAPA, P-O-P-P-A, as one of their teams. If you see pictures of me, you see a red trailer. Again, I think the statutes run. That red trailer used to be blue. We stole it, painted it red. We took it from the police department. You'll get it back someday. But the people would go to the first aid tent and say, hey, would you go next door? I need to talk to somebody. People were scared out of their minds to say, hey, I don't feel right. I don't feel well. Something's not clicking. And we did speak with them and did our best. But to this day, many of us in police, fire, EMS, military, don't ever want to admit that something's bothering us. And that's a very sad thing.
That's very poignant, thank you. I think for all of us here in the audience and myself, in those days that followed, whether you guys knew it or not, and I'm going to ask that in a second, it was a pretty dark time, and you guys really gave this country hope in a time that we didn't have a lot of it. Were you aware of that, and how did you feel if you were that, and did you feel that the country was behind you guys? What was your sort of feeling of that?
For me, I didn't even enter my mind, to be very honest. We were so busy, it was basically a blur the first 2 months for me. We just had a job to do when we were doing it, but now in retrospect, looking back, it's pretty incredible.
It was definitely a show of pride. People were very kind to us, you know, waving, cheering us on. I have a funny story. I was going to get a cup of coffee about the third, fourth day, and we were up so many hours, so we were on patrol, back on patrol, and I said to my partner, pull over here quick, I'm going to go in and get a cup of coffee. And I walk in, make two cups of coffee, and I put it on the counter, and the guy behind me says, don't worry about it, I'll pay for his coffee. Now, I can't do that, technically can't accept that, but the owner says, no, we're not charging, don't worry about it. So I'm standing there, and the third person, this is how divided everything could be, third person says, he's not allowed to accept that coffee, I'll report him. So now the guy behind me turns around him and says, I'm going to beat your. So now I can't take the coffee. I have to escort this idiot out of the building so he doesn't get beat up.
I remember my memory of it when we talk about it was I remember, and this will be wild to think about, but my dad was on a waiting list to get a new American flag. He could not get an American flag. Every store was sold out. His had
gotten kind of worn out, so he didn't want to fly a worn out American flag in our house, and he was on a 2-week waiting list to get one. And I remember when he finally got it, he was excited. But that's the one thing that always stuck in my mind was that.
Chris, from our point of view, we did know it locally. As Dave pointed out, people were delivering food to our unit. We didn't ask for it. People would, and in the aviation world, we would get parts and boxes from various vendors around the country. They would write notes on the box, quite colorful notes, kick, yeah, and they were, so we were aware of the sentiment, and it meant the world to us then, and it means the world to us today.
Chris, on the president's third visit, basically 3 days after September 11th when we brought him to Ground Zero, he stood on the rubble of the fire truck, and that video was shown to us a million times. I mean, I would show it to others because it was the most impressive sight of the first responders. I mean, he's on the with the megaphone, and he's talking to the first responders, and the first responders are yelling, "Go get him, George!" And then somebody yells out, "We can't hear you!" And the president goes, "I can hear you!" And then they all start laughing and pushing, and then all of a sudden the president says, "And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear from all of us soon." And the whole place just busts out into USA, USA. From that point forward, everywhere we took President Bush, people would come together. It didn't matter whether you were watching Fox or CNN or whatever, they came together as Americans everywhere we went. Thousands of people that would never show up for events would come to the side of the plane and just start chanting USA, USA. I mean, the country came together. I mean, it's just something that occurred, but it literally, everyone looked to New York. Everything was happening in New York because New York came together. We flew Mayor Giuliani a bunch of times, sat up in the cockpit with me, and he was America's mayor. I mean, he was an amazing man at that point. I'm not saying he is not, but
he was younger then.
He was younger then, absolutely. So, but all of us, we were amazed everything that New York was doing, and we would follow it, and America would follow it. It didn't matter, whether it was CNN or Fox reporting it. It was always the same report. America and New York had come back together again, and the firefighters, first responders, police, everybody was back together again. And that's how America stood strong. It was an incredible time.
I wish he was here. He was going to be here. Unfortunately, he lost his firefighting brother. Charlie Bleach was going to be here with us tonight. My favorite kind of humorous story Charlie told me is and you probably were there with him, was that he's in the midst of trying to organize how to get, water to the fires and things like that. And he said, this gentleman comes over and he says, "We're with this fireboat in New York and we're ready to pump." And they named the fireboat, and Charlie says, "We don't have a fireboat by that name." And here it was a museum ship built in like the 1800s that they brought over to pump water. And I think they did pump water, if I was correct. Do you remember that?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Charlie, one day Charlie and Lee, my colleagues, were going to funerals when they could. One day they left me in charge. I was at Station 7. You never want to be in charge. My name's on my shirt, in 12-inch high letters. Guy walks in a business suit. He said, "Who's in charge?" Everybody points to me. Never, ever a good thing. And he said, I'll change the name. "My name is John Smith, United Nations." "Well, sir, how can I help you?" He said, "I'm here to file a complaint because you're removing victims from countries under an American flag." And there were 80 different nations. And I said, "You got to be kidding me," in a little bit more colorful language than that. And he said, "You're being rude." I said, "No, sir, we have no way of knowing where these folks are from. So everybody gets put in a Stokes basket and an American flag and treated with respect." He wrote a letter. The next day at the command post meeting, Mayor Giuliani's there. Meeting's going on for an hour. And the meeting's all over, someone says, "Who's Fagel?" They all point to me. I'm going, dead man walking. I walk up to the mayor, and he says, "Hi, I'm Rudy." "Yes, Mr. Mayor." He said, "Did you have an altercation with the United Nations yesterday?" I said, "Well, sir, I didn't hit him." And he said, "Well, they don't like you. And they wrote that I was rude, etc." So the mayor just tore the letter up and threw it away. Fast forward to 3 years later, I'm the United Nations going to be giving a speech. And that letter still existed. And I told the security guy I was with it, before I set foot on your property, can you see if there's anything in the files? He said, oh, you've been a bad boy. Delete. Weird things, weird things.
We have a lot of questions, so I do want to shift to a little bit of Q&A, and then we have something really kind of special we're going to end it with, which we're going to have Mark tee up, and then we'll end it with the video there. But let me ask just a few questions here for you guys. Was there anything operationally from everybody here that changed that you can think of right away from that day? Any sort of reaction or anything like that we learned from, that we went and did something different?
I think from the fire department standpoint, we learned how to accept help. You know, we're one of the biggest, if not the biggest fire department in the world, maybe the greatest, I might be biased, but we never really had any event so large that we needed help. We always handled it in-house, and obviously that was not happening here. And I think it was the Forestry Service and their incident management team that came in and sat for a while and watched, you know, a lot of mistakes being made, and they sat back and said, listen, you guys do whatever you want to do, but we have a system for the whole country that we have, incident management teams that fly in and take over when it's overwhelming for the area, and everything was modular form with a incident control and command where, you know, they put us in charge of the operations, and they did the logistics, you know, the finance, and they took care of everything else for us. And now we're in the system of the incident management team where we can accept help. And now we have teams that go out and help other people in other events.
I think we learned, Chris, the NYPD is a couple things. Number one, don't have plans A, B, C, and D. You have to have all the way to Z. On September 10th, if I had been in a meeting and said, I think there's going to be four airliners that are going to crash in the United States tomorrow, I would have been labeled a lunatic. Like, that's never going to happen. And that's exactly what happened. We did all commands in the NYPD had to come up with what we called the standalone plan, 96 hours. How would you survive for 96 hours without any direction from the top? Because we had very little direction. So each unit had to come up with this 96-hour plan, how we would operate without direction from upper command. And counterterrorism became the watchword of the decade. We got more assets, and we changed some of our operations to address that issue.
I think the incident action planning that we did, we had to reconstitute the New York team and the New Jersey teams. There's 28 teams throughout the country, FEMA response teams. They wanted to come in, and we had to keep them held back just in case there was another event. We didn't want everybody to show up. The Arizona team came in, we welcomed them, the Alaska team. We did safety, logistics, planning, finance, all those things. And the New York City fire guys started to get more engaged with the incident action planning process on a daily basis, not for the big one, and that really helped. I think that was a major change. Everybody started absorbing what we were trying to do.
One of the questions that came in was, you know, it's obviously an issue with the physical health of a lot of people that work the pile. You know, can you guys weigh in on that at all and talk about what that whole situation is?
Sure. Sadly, more first responders have passed post 9/11 than the day of the event. And I always tell people, I ask everyone to remember, the attack is not over. It still continues to take the lives of a lot of our colleagues, our friends. A dear friend of mine about a month ago passed away from 9/11 related cancer. So the attack in our world, it's not over. It still continues each and every day. I have many friends who are still quite ill over it, and it's gonna last another, this attack will last another 30, 40, 50 years until the last of us are gone.
One of the questions was, were any of you aware of, you know, John Stewart's been a champion of that. Have you been any of those hearings or anything like that, or know anybody that has?
Yeah, we all knew it, yeah.
Okay.
Let's see, for each member, is there, what was the biggest lesson you learned from the day yourself, personally?
Don't do it alone. You need help. New York City Fire, marvelous people, and NYPD, we all gathered in one room to work on the mission together. Some people said there was animosity between agencies. Those days, those weeks, those months, there was none. Everybody pulled on the same piece of rope and just rolled up their sleeves and worked the best they could to help everybody get where we finally wound up. It was a team effort, and it didn't matter what patch was on your sleeve. Everybody pulled in the same direction. That was marvelous.
I would say never say never. Always, you know, I think one of the things that happened after 9/11 was training and communications. I measure everything pre and post September 11th, what we were afforded, what we were allowed to do as local law enforcement or fire service. And then all of a sudden, when we asked for things after 9/11, it wasn't so silly. It was okay. And there were funding, there was money, you know, things like that. A lot more training.
I think our museum here, we've started every September 11th, we do something. A lot of folks might ask, you know, wow, you're doing, you know, September 11th, it's 25 years. That blew by for me. I mean, 25 years is pretty fast. And every September 11th, we do something here. And I did just want to tell a story. I'm very proud of the fact that it was under my leadership here that we started that program. Every 9/11, we get somebody here. That's how I know all these guys, except for Jeannie. We go way back on other projects. But I remember my first call to get somebody. I wanted somebody from New York. I thought that was important. And we called the FDNY first, and they said, you know, we don't really do that. We called the NYPD, and the NYPD's reaction was, it was just really funny, and I do a lousy New York impression, but the guy goes, "Where are you at?" And I said, "Wisconsin," and he says, "Get out of here." Except he said something more colorful, too. And and then he says, "Oh, I got just a guy." And he sent us Rich from the aviation unit, Rich Noller. And then I called the next year the fire department and said, you know, we'd love to have it. And he says, "Yeah, you know, we don't really do that." And I said, "Okay, I was just wondering because the NYPD sent us somebody last year." And I'll never forget the FDNY. They go, "The cops sent you somebody." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "All right, how many guys did they send you?" And I said, "Well, one." They said, "We're going to send you a couple guys. Don't worry. We'll find somebody." But it's been wonderful since. Without the support, and all joking aside, from the NYPD and FDNY, these guys wouldn't have been here. They helped me locate you guys and get you here. Mark Tillman and Mark Ramsey, you guys are longtime EA members. You're kind of extended family, as well as Jeannie. But I do appreciate you guys. It's a sensitive subject. I do appreciate you guys coming out here talking about it. I felt it was only right that we do something for the 25th. And as we start to lead away, I know when I had Mark Tillman here, he told me the story, and I just think it's an appropriate way to wrap our evening here. But Mark, can you tell me about taking the president back to New York for the first pitch? Not yet, guys. I know you're excited for that video, but we are going to end it with a video. In case you didn't know, there is a video up there. But can you just tell us first about this?
Yeah, the president made the decision to throw out the first pitch at the Yankees-Arizona Diamondbacks game. The World Series is going on. So the challenge was there are numerous threats still up in the New York area. So the plan was we gave him an Air Force One jacket, second chance vest underneath. So he had basically two bulletproof vests and then an Air Force One jacket. But he had to throw the pitch. And then when he got to New York, they gave him a fire department jacket as well. And we took off the Air Force One jacket. He put that on. And then he's literally out there throwing from the rubber. If you haven't done that ever yet, you need to. But on the flight from Washington, D.C., he's literally in the jet warming up, throwing a ball. And he's just tossing the ball back and forth. You know, it meant an awful lot to him. And that's how all this started. But you've got the video, and the video is incredible.
We're going to roll the video in a second. And in an only Oshkosh kind of way, I do want to say thank you. The New York Yankees actually made this available to us so we can show that here tonight. So let's go ahead and roll this this video. It's about 3 or 4 minutes.
People are lined up 10, 20, 50 deep. It's a mob scene outside. Much more of a police presence. And you go through the magnetometer, hand search. This had another level of intensity to it. I remember seeing guys holding automatic weapons, and I remember thinking to myself, this is now my America.
Walking into the locker room and seeing a bomb dog go through your locker. These were reminders of what was going on around us.
Another reason for the heightened security was the appearance of a guest from Washington.
As we walked into the locker room, there was a gentleman standing there we had never seen before. He says, well, President Bush is going to come, and he's going to throw out the first pitch, and we need a Secret Service agent on the field, and so I'm going to dress as an umpire. He had communications, he had guns, he had things hooked on the back, he had things hooked on the front. And I said, how are you going to hide all that stuff? He says, don't worry, he says, it'll disappear. All of a sudden, there was a knock at the door. And President Bush walked into our room.
Thank you. Will you do me a favor and say hi to my son, because he's one of your biggest supporters? Jimmy?
What's his name, Jimmy?
Jimmy.
Jimmy, how are you?
Well, when you're president, all you have to do is say you're showing up. And they kind of ask you to throw out the first pitch, no matter what time of year it is.
This is my first World Series.
Is it really?
Yeah. I vowed I'd never go to a World Series unless the Rangers got in. And I changed that vow.
You know, I wanted to make sure that if I was going to throw out the ball, I was able to do so with a little zip. You know, I didn't want people to think that their president was incapable of finding the plate. So I go underneath the Yankee Stadium, in the bowels of Yankee Stadium, and there's a hitting cage there.
And he's wearing his bulletproof jacket, and he's getting his arm loose. And Derek Jeter comes up to him.
Hey, Prez, how are you doing? Good, Derek. It's good luck tonight. Thank you, sir. And he says, say, I hear you're throwing out the first ball.
So I just asked him if he was going to be throwing the first pitch from the mound or in front of the mound. The
president said, I think I'll throw from the base of the mound. Jeter said, I wouldn't do that if I were you, Mr. President.
And I told him, you better throw it from the mound, otherwise you're going to get booed. I said, this is Yankee Stadium.
I said, okay, I'll throw from the mound. And he's walking out, and he looks over his shoulder, and he says, don't bounce it. They'll boo you. And so the pressure all of a sudden, I mean, I'm sitting there kind of fairly relaxed and feeling fairly loose, and the great Derek Jeter, don't bounce it. They'll boo you. And all of a sudden, the pressure mounted.
The President of the United States.
I'd never felt what I'd felt before when I walked out of that dugout. I felt the raw emotion of the Yankee fans.
USA! USA! USA!
The crowd just erupts in a chant of USA. There is nothing like it that I've ever experienced at a ballgame. It was overwhelming. It was just overwhelming.
President Bush is standing out there like a brick wall. I'm not afraid of terrorists. I'm going to stand all out here. I'm going to give you a thumbs up. And I'm going to throw a strike.
I didn't vote for him, but at that point, my personal feelings about him as a politician is gone. I watched him, and he was my representative, and I had never felt that way before.
Very nice throw, Mr. President. Good stuff, good stuff.
At that moment, everybody there was there for baseball and to show the world that in spite of what can happen to us, we'll pull ourselves together, and what is our life and our way of life will continue.
United we stand. We stand together in the face of this threat. We will play baseball in the midst of the beginnings of this war. No matter what the threat may be to us, the United States of America will stand strong and will never be intimidated.